It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll take a look at the annual State of Working Wisconsin report. This year shows some improvement for the state's economy, but the report says there's still work to be done.
But first, according to a recent study in the American Journal of Sports Medicine, the rate of concussions among high school athletes across the nation has more than doubled between 2005 and 2012.
And this kind of research has a lot of parents concerned. They might feel like they're walking a fine line between letting their kids play these contact sports, things like football, but also wanting to ensure that they have the best protective gear when they do it.
Researchers at UW-Madison recently looked into claims by sports equipment manufacturers that some products may better protect young athletes from concussion risk. The study involved more than 2,000 high school football players at 34 high schools across Wisconsin during the 2012 and 2013 seasons. The lead co-investigator of that study, Dr. Allison Brooks, joins us now. She's an assistant professor in the UW Department of Orthopedics and Rehabilitation. Allison, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
So going in, what did you expect to find when it comes to how well helmets work?
Well, this research study really was generated by a lot of, you know, questions from our community, athletes, their parents, coaches, athletic directors, you know, who were getting approached by different manufacturers saying, you know, you need to buy this or that helmet. Our helmet works better than the other helmet. And there was a lot of confusion about whether that was really true. And when we went and looked at the scientific evidence behind it, there really wasn't a whole lot there. So we felt we were in a position to try and help answer this really important question for not just our community here in Dane County, but in our state as a whole. And we were expecting actually to find what we found, which is all of the, you know, newer modern helmets that have been manufactured in the last 5 or 10 years all do an excellent job to do what they are designed to do, which is prevent catastrophic injury like intracranial bleed or skull fracture. But there wasn't one clear, you know, brand of helmet that was substantially better at reducing the risk of concussion compared to its competitors.
That's interesting because, you know, if you're a parent, you've got a kid playing contact football, you may think, you know, we get the state-of-the-art gear, which has been engineered for safety, that the result will be fewer concussions. But it's interesting that that was not even remotely the case.
Well, I think one thing to remember is, you know, in the study overall, I think there were 14 different makes and models of helmets that kids were wearing. But the majority of them, I think almost over 85% of them, were in one of five helmets made by the top three manufacturers, you know, Riddell, Schutt, or Zenith. And among those sort of most commonly used helmets that are, you know, are all, you know, much more modern design than what was being used in the 1990s and really even the early 2000s, they all seem to do, you know, a relatively equally good job of protecting kids. I think we don't want parents to have this false sense of security that if I buy the newest, you know, latest, greatest, most expensive, fanciest helmet, that my child doesn't have a risk of concussion. I really think that that is just not the case.
Now, the study also looked at the relationship between mouth guards and concussion risk. What did you find there?
Well, we were surprised with that result, which was that kids who were wearing, you know, a custom mouth guard, meaning it was, you know, molded either by a dentist or some other way, and specifically, you know, customized for that athlete, that they were actually at higher risk of concussion compared to the kids who were just, you know, wearing the old generic boil and bite mouth guards. And I really don't think that means that the mouth guard is causing more concussions. I think it means that we're not measuring something else. Like, there was some other reason that those kids were potentially wearing the custom mouth guards, or maybe they were, you know, playing in higher risk positions, or I think we don't have a really good explanation for that finding. That certainly was surprising.
Well, and in terms of, you know, the final end goal here, which is cutting down on concussions, some things that parents and coaches might try is, you know, having fewer incidences of contact practice or having players with more experience who knew how to avoid the tough hits on the head. What about those factors?
Well, we were able to look at some of those in the study that was just recently published. Specifically, not surprisingly, the rate of concussion in games was dramatically higher than it was in practice. But even when we looked at, full contact practice versus no contact practice, the rate of concussion was almost four times higher, obviously, in practices that involved full contact. And we did look at, we asked players to report, how many years they had been playing tackle football. And that didn't seem to be a protective effect, meaning, we had some kids who had been playing tackle football for, five, six, 7 years or more, and they didn't seem to be sustaining concussions at a lower rate than other kids who were newer to tackle football.
So what about someone who's playing on the varsity team versus someone who's just beginning? Is there a differential there in the concussion rate?
We looked at that as well, what their grade in school was, as well as the level they were competing at, whether it was, freshman, JV, or varsity. And none of those factors really seemed to matter either. What did matter was an athlete's previous history of concussion. So those athletes who had already sustained a concussion, either whether it was another lifetime concussion or a concussion within the last 12 months, they were at almost twice the risk of getting another concussion in that season.
So it's an interesting thing. You looked at the helmets, that didn't seem to matter. Practice and experience didn't seem to matter. What would make a difference? Did your study point you in the direction of anything that could help cut that concussion risk?
Well, I think obviously there's a lot of interest right now in limiting contact to the head, and one way to do that is to limit how much contact is occurring in practices. And the WIAA actually this summer voted to limit how much contact there can be in practice for this high school football season. So actually we have extended the study an additional year to look at whether that rule change makes a difference. Are we seeing fewer concussions in practice and potentially games related to sort of overall kids being exposed to less head contact? So I think that's one area, and I think rule enforcement is another area. I mean, obviously there are already rules in place about not spearing and leading with your head. And I really think, from an officiating and a coaching standpoint, we really need to teach players that the head is just off limits. It's not a weapon. It really, you want to avoid contact with your head, if at all possible.
In terms of parents and schools, coaches who are buying protective gear for their athletes, is there anything that they can do to buy the right stuff that's going to keep the kids safe and especially kids' heads safe?
Well, I think the message that we wanted to give, the coaches and the athletes who were in our study was that, that buying a $500 helmet doesn't necessarily seem to be buying you, as opposed to a $300 helmet. I'm not sure what the return on that investment is, or even a $200 helmet. So if you have a child or an athlete who really likes, a particular helmet, it fits them well, you make sure it's properly fitted, it's, well-maintained, it's in good condition, you inspect it every year, make sure the helmet isn't damaged, the athlete's wearing it appropriately, then you've done your job. Spending $300 more on a helmet isn't necessarily going to dramatically increase that athlete's risk of injury. So, buy the modern equipment, the newer designs, but make sure your kids are wearing the helmets appropriately, they're properly fit, and that they find that the helmet is comfortable. Because if the helmet is not comfortable, then they're probably not going to wear it appropriately.
Allison, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure thing.
That was Dr. Allison Brooks, assistant professor in the UW Department of Orthopedics and Rehabilitation.
The Center on Wisconsin Strategy just released its annual State of Working Wisconsin report yesterday on Labor Day. The report says things are getting better in some ways for workers in Wisconsin with a lot of room for improvement.
Laura Dresser is here to talk about that report. She's the associate director of the Center on Wisconsin Strategy. Excuse me, Laura. Welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you take a snapshot of how Wisconsin is doing employment-wise each Labor Day. So how are things looking for Wisconsin workers this year?
Well, there's always a short-term obsession, and there should be, with where jobs are right now. Compared to 2 years ago, we have more jobs now. That's good news. Unemployment rate's down a little bit. I think we've seen some steady, if slow, progress on the jobs front. So it's not as bad as it was 2 years ago, but it's, there's still, like you said, a lot of room for improvement.
Well, the national economy finally got back to pre-recession job benchmarks. And how about Wisconsin?
Yeah, Wisconsin is running behind the national economy. So basically, over the recovery, the national economy produced 6% jobs. Wisconsin growth was about 4%. Every time a state the size of Wisconsin could expect 3 jobs in that case, we got 2. That puts us about 58,000 jobs behind where we would be had we just grown at the national rate. Even growing at the national rate isn't really enough, given the way the population has grown. So just getting back to 2007, given that we have a bigger population today, is not great news on its own.
So those benchmark numbers are even higher when you factor in population growth.
Right. If you think about population growth, if you look at just how we've lagged the national, we're 58,000 jobs behind. If you look at what we need to keep up with population growth, we need twice that, about 130,000 jobs. If we were really going to feel like 2007, the level of employment, the number of hours, the number of jobs, that kind of demand, that kind of position for workers, we won't see that for a few years.
Do you have a sense why Wisconsin is lagging behind the national average?
Well, that's the we call that the 58,000 job question. There's a few answers that are go-to answers on the state of Wisconsin. One, when the Wisconsin economy deviates from the national, you look for manufacturing to explain it. And here, actually, manufacturing works the opposite direction. If manufacturing, our state's manufacturing sector has outperformed the national rate. So if we had taken out that good performance, we'd be doing even worse. It's not manufacturing that explains the difference. What it is, it's general softness in three different key sectors: leisure and hospitality, business and professional services, and transportation, trade, and utilities. Now, that's a mixed bag. I think that's just generally overall slow. The other one that doesn't explain it that people want to look to is public sector employment. We've lost public sector jobs, but the national action picture would have lost more. A state, the Wisconsin side, would have lost more than we had. And I think that's because Act 10 took, kind of an across-the-board approach instead of a shrinking the number of jobs approach.
And in a related aspect here, you looked at how Act 10 affected unionization, and that's not, I guess, really a surprise. Unionization down.
Yeah, right. Here's many things I look at are sort of obvious, but this is one that's worth documenting, at least. Act 10 made it harder to be in a public sector union and, in fact, had very evident effect just from 2011 to 2012. But the place where you can see it most clearly, you look at the state level, you run about 50% down to 35%. Represented by a union in a public sector job. But if you look in Dane County over that 1 year, 2011 to 2012, the public sector unionization rate goes in half from over 50% to 25%. And that's interesting here in Dane County, where we know the county workers, the city workers, many of the teachers all are running on extended contracts. That's just the impact on state workers.
So that bigger chunk of unionization loss is because of the state jobs here in Dane County,
yeah,
is what you're saying.
Right. And so concentrated here, and more loss to come, but cutting in half in a single year is pretty significant.
So in terms of forecasting, if we look at, I guess, that aspect, you said more jobs or more union spots lost. Why are you predicting that?
Because we know that contracts will go. There's a few factors that kind of make sure that Act 10 will continue to have impact, not just a first year. In fact, one is that some unions got extended contracts by bargaining right before the act went into effect. They got extensions on their contract. When those go away, then they will enter the Act 10 world, and probably at least a few of them won't pursue becoming recertified, and some of them won't win their recertification votes. But then there's a pretty high standard on the annual need to recertify that I think will wear even very committed union people down over a set of years.
So that's something you're going to be tracking as we move forward.
We'll watch that number probably continue to fall.
Another point in your report is the issue of median hourly wage growth or stagnation, whichever it is. But why don't you tell us what you found there?
Well, here, this is when we step back and really look at the last 35 years. What's happened to the worker in the exact middle of the labor market? If we correct for inflation, hold it all in 2013 dollars, and look back to 1979, what was the median worker making? $16.50 an hour. Think of that as $33,000 annual with a full-time job. You look forward to 2013, and that worker right in the middle of the labor force is earning $17 an hour, $34,000 a year. That's 34 years of economic growth, higher productivity, and the median worker has gotten a raise of between 1 and 2 cents a year each year. That's going nowhere, really. That's a kind of stagnation at the middle of the labor market that I think is a challenge to everybody who's looking at the labor market. I think we focus a lot on those short-term jobs numbers and all that, but the long-term trend has been this stagnation at the middle, and that's where Wisconsin and the nation's economic challenges are.
So it's 50 cents since 1979. Now, if you want to look at a space for motion, do you see any opportunity for movement there?
Definitely. For a long time in the post-war period, basically from 45 to 79, when the economy grew, the median wage, the worker's wage at the median grew as well. And what we've had now over the last 35 years is consistent economic growth without any consistent payoff at the median. And that has to do with a lot of different things going on in the economy. But yes, we can do better than that. We've done better in the past, and we can do better going forward.
And how about what might be caused by the fact that there seem to be fewer full-time jobs and more people cobbling together different part-time jobs?
Well, this is a real challenge in the labor market. And our data, even the federal sources of data are not great on this. But we know that when the unemployment rate is high, that workers, especially in retail and leisure and hospitality, home health care, work on a much more on-call basis. And this means that a low wage is compounded by volatile and unpredictable hours. So workers, you know, they go into work, they show up, but then, they do a floor count of the number of customers that are there. And some employers will just send you home if there aren't enough people. So if there's a traffic accident or a rainstorm, you go home. And it's, you know, the strategy when you have low hours is to get another job. But when you have all these on-call hours, it's almost impossible to get another job because you can't manage, you know, the kind of conflicting volatile hours.
And to move on to another point in the report, you took a look at the racial inequality in the job market. Now, this remains a pretty worrisome point. What are you seeing here?
Yeah, you know, the state of Wisconsin, I think folks here tend to think, oh, you know, racial inequality, that happens everywhere. You know, Wisconsin consistently is at the top of the charts. And here we looked at the unemployment rate in 2013 for blacks in the state was 15%, 15% being a sort of Great Depression level of unemployment, by the way. That's 2.8 times the white rate. That ratio, that disparity between white and African-American rates, there's only three states and Washington, D.C. that have higher disparity than we do. So, yeah. So this is true across the board on stats from Wisconsin, whether it's educational indicators, incarceration, economic outcomes, et cetera. You see very high levels of disparity.
And how do things look for Hispanic workers?
Hispanic workers are actually unemployed about the same as African-Americans. That disparity runs closer to national norms. It's a pretty appalling level of disparity, but we're kind of more like everybody else on that.
So when you put this into context, how do those numbers affect the overall jobs picture that you're seeing?
Well, I think the problem that you see is a kind of weak economy. It's moving in the right direction, and that's absolutely critical. We have 100,000 more jobs today than we did 2 years ago. That's good news. Workers feel that difference, whether they're looking for work and it's easier to get work, or whether they're asking for, you know, an afternoon off to go help their kid with something. It's different when there's more jobs and when the economy is moving in that direction. Still, it is so weak by even the comparison to 2007. And the median wage trend is so muted by comparison to that post-war period. I think those are the real challenges that this report calls out for us.
We're talking right now to Laura Dresser from the Center on Wisconsin Strategy about their recent State of Working Wisconsin report.
And we want to get your input and maybe your story. What does the economy look like in your community, in your household, on your paycheck? If you're in the job market, have things started looking up over the last few years? Are you cobbling together a couple of part-time jobs? Are you in one of those new on-call service professions that Laura Dresser was just talking about? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us, talk@wpr.org. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation now with Laura Dresser from the Center on Wisconsin Strategy about this year's State of Working Wisconsin report.
And we're taking your calls now. When it comes to jobs and the economy, what's the story where you are in your community, your county? Are things looking up lately? And how about for you, if you've been in the job market over the last few years? Are things getting easier? More jobs out there for you? Or cobbling together part-time jobs to keep things together? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@wpr.org.
And we're going to start off with our callers. Now, Mike joins us from Madison. Hi, Mike.
Good afternoon. I was hoping your guests could maybe give a little historical perspective on what advantages Wisconsin had 100 years ago to attract businesses, whether it be railroads, fresh water, resources, and what advantages Wisconsin has currently to keep businesses here, and why they might not want to just relocate to Tennessee. You know, we can educate our students here, but they'll just take a higher-paying job down in Tennessee or Arkansas. Fresh water is available there. And so what's our advantage up here? That's, you know, really what I'm looking for is to see why somebody like Harley Davidson and Mercury Marine and Ashley Furniture would not relocate 5 or 10 years from now further south where the labor rates are much cheaper.
All right. Thanks a lot, Mike. Laura?
Well, the real question, of course, it's a mixed question on the cost of labor and the productivity you get out of labor and also the infrastructure you have for development. So the things that really build our economic development or economic advantages in the long run are a strong workforce, decent skills, decent schools, a good work ethic, and a strong infrastructure, whether that's rails or broadband or utilities. Those things really matter. And those are things that Wisconsin has always excelled in, especially the strength of the training systems for working people in manufacturing and other industries. The technical colleges are pretty strong here. We have many more workers who have gotten their associate's degrees in technical degrees and who do better than their national counterparts in the labor market. That's a consistent strength. I'm not quite sure I can get back to 100 years ago, but certainly historically. Looking forward, that investments in the technical colleges, the school system, and the, you know, making utilities and infrastructure for development, whether that's railroads or highways or broadband, you know, all those things matter moving forward in this economy. And I think especially the ability to move goods and services and electrons around will become increasingly important. And that takes money. That takes a real state investment in the infrastructure in our human capital and our physical capital for development in the future.
Now, Laura, I want to ask you, you know, jobs, obviously the big issue in this year's governor's race. Now, given your report that we're talking about right now, is this, you know, good news, middling good news, bad news, or just kind of eh?
Well, I think, you know, I think it's right that jobs are the big issue in the governor's race because, partly they've been made the big issues through the promise. They're also the big issue in the economy. This is the first hurt in this long-term painful economy is the lack of jobs and the lack of demand and the way that works against unemployed workers, et cetera. You know, But on the other side of the coin, I don't really believe that governors are the final control of the number of jobs in any economy. We're tied to a national economy. We're tied to a global economy. So to make, you know, to make that the bottom line of whether someone's working or not sometimes feels like a bit of an overreach. But yes, you know, clearly jobs are where people are hurting, and that's what people are looking for.
Okay, we're going to go back to our phone lines. We've got a lot of folks waiting to talk to you, and we're going to go to Laura in Waukesha next. Hi, Laura.
Hi there. I'm with a staffing firm in Waukesha, so I see a lot of the ups and downs within the job job economy, if you will. And what I see is companies are looking for skilled employees, and they're willing to hold out and wait. They're not willing to train, and that's becoming a big problem because the skilled people, they're working, and they're not interested in moving around.
All right. Well, thank you, Laura, for that insight there. And what do you think?
I think, you know, that's an interesting point. I think that there is has been, you know, one thing is that when employers and people in staffing services firms are closer to this than I am, but when employers get used to long lines waiting, applying for every job, they begin to sort on things that they didn't have to in the past. And I do agree, you know, I think there's significant evidence that employers are now expecting a kind of level of exact experience that they are finding harder to get to. You know, there's a couple ways to get around that. One is to train, as she pointed out, and another is to raise the wage. And to change the incentive. And so when there's a conversation about skill shortages, I think we've not paid enough attention to the evidence of whether we really see wage increases that really indicate an underlying skill shortage or whether it's a kind of hesitance of employers to invest. And I think we've seen evidence of both.
Do you think that we'll see a time when that flip-flops again, or are we just, is this a feature of the new economy?
You know, I think that's a very large question. How damped is demand going forward? Will technology to continue to replace people and so leave some greater and greater share of people out of this labor force? You know, I think we'll continue to see some growth. It probably is not going to be as strong as the late 90s for a while, at least. And that means that people, you know, it'll tip slowly and hopefully, I hope, it continues to tip more in favor of workers and their ability to kind of make a better deal for themselves. But it's certainly the case that this has been a upper hand for employers for quite some time.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot for your call, Laura. And we're going to move next to Melissa in Racine. Hi, Melissa.
Hi. I was just wondering if your guest investigated the potential economic impact of the proposed casino in the Racine and Kenosha area.
No, I haven't. I haven't. Investigated that. A lot of people, of course, are weighing in on that. I think the net effect on jobs would probably be positive, but it would relocate some stuff around. I have no idea.
Okay, we'll come back to that. I think everyone wants to know that right now.
Yeah, exactly.
Check that out as time unfolds. Well, there is some good news, I think, sort of. Well, I was going to say unalloyed good news, but that's not quite right either. But there is a bright spot in terms of the gender gap in Wisconsin. What can you tell us about where we are?
Yeah, you know, this is the long-term good story in the American economy and in Wisconsin as well. In 1979, the median female worker earned 59 cents for every dollar a man made. That gap has shrunk to 82 cents now. So there's 82 cents on the dollar at the median, comparing the median male and female worker in Wisconsin. You know, the good news on that is that that has been because of increases in women's wages over the last 35 years. The median woman earns more than she did 35 years ago. But it's also that gap has shrunk also because the median man earns less than he did 35 years ago. And obviously, the median man still earns more than the median woman. But that gender gap has shrunk on both sides. And I think, you know, equity achieved at $5 an hour will not feel like progress in a way. I think that, you know, helping to see women's wages go up is a big part of that story.
And why are men's wages falling?
Men's wages are falling. Again, this is a huge question. But one way to look at this is men's wages are falling, especially for the 70% of the workforce who doesn't have a 2 or a 4 year college degree or more education. That's where wages are really coming down. And why are wages coming down there? Because we've lost so many manufacturing jobs, because manufacturing jobs pay less than they used to, because we've deunionized across the board, especially in male jobs. And this is true in construction. Looking at, for example, commercial construction is still largely union, but residential in the state no longer. So deunionization matters there. The falling value of the minimum wage matters. All that has happened that pulls down the wages at for workers with that less than college degrees. The trends have been better for both men and women with college degrees and more.
And Laura, you've got part two of this report coming out in the fall. Can you give us a sneak preview?
Yes. Poverty and income data gets released by the federal government. There's two batches that come out, one in August and one in September. And we decided this year to wait till the September batch comes out and then focus on income and poverty in a second part two, State of Working Wisconsin, which of course has the acronym SOW. So
it's convenient for you guys.
It's every bacon joke we can make. we'll be releasing the income and poverty data later.
All right. So we'll expect that in September, October. And Laura, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thanks for having me.
That was Laura Dresser, Associate Director of the Center on Wisconsin Strategy. She was with us to talk about this year's State of Working Wisconsin report.
It's time for this week's Teach Me What You Know. Last week, we learned how to dominate our fantasy football leagues.
Today, a little advice for the wannabe craftsperson from a professional inventor and maker. We'll get the lowdown on Drilling 101.
Steve Hofer is an inventor and he's a writer. His work appears in Make Magazine and at his Gratheo Labs website. His piece in Boing Boing, A Beginner's Guide to Drills and Bits, is linked on our Central Time Facebook page. Steve, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, before we get into drill bits, there's probably two reactions out there. Some people are thinking, drilling, of course. I've known how to do that since I was a kid. Other people saying, I wouldn't trust myself to hold a drill, much less plug it in. Are we getting distanced to maybe younger generations from that old standard of do-it-yourself and doing these jobs on our own?
Well, I think a lot of these things are a little bit less common than they used to be, although with the popularity of flat pack furniture and, you know, other things like this, do-it-yourselfing is having a bit of a resurgence. So getting the basic tool usage, which certainly a lot of us have done since we were very young, I think getting those skills a little bit refreshed is worth the time.
Well, and when I want to make a hole in something, I would just grab a drill, get the bit that looks like it's close to the right size, and go for it. In your piece, you lay out a whole bunch of different kinds of drill bits that I didn't know about. So I want to go through some of those and what we'd use them for. The basic, and this is what I'd picture with a drill bit, I imagine, is the twist. That's the standard. What do I want to do with that one?
You could do a lot with the twist bit. Most of the things you're going to want to do around the house, if you're installing shelving or things of that sort, are the twist bits. They're the ones that I think most people think of when they think of bits. It's a cylinder with a little spiral down the side, a little pointy end. Great for drilling through softer materials, wood, good for putting smaller holes, I guess smaller about half inch or smaller holes and things. They're the really good general purpose drill bits. They do come in a couple of different grades, we'll say. The cheap ones you'll find, maybe the ones that come with a tool set, are usually softer steel, good for drilling in wood, maybe some plastic, drywall. If you want to start drilling harder materials, such as steel or other metals, you want to find high-speed steel or carbide tip bits. That can withstand the higher pressures and greater heat. Higher holes.
Before we get into the other kinds of bits and the jobs we'd use them for, is there a similar quality difference with the drills themselves? If we think, okay, I'm going to be super do-it-yourself person, I'm going to be using this tool a lot, is it worth getting something a little better? How do we evaluate the drill we buy?
There are a few different ways. I tend to say stay away from the ones that are hand-powered, the ones that you have to turn a crank, because they're simply very difficult to use, especially for a beginner, to turn the crank and to get the pressure in the right direction and everything. It can be very difficult for a beginner. So go with the electric ones. Cost a little bit more. It is worth it to spend a little more money than the bottom of the line ones. It all, of course, depends on how much you think you're going to be using them. But the more expensive ones, especially important features, would be variable speed. The trigger on it sort of works like a gas pedal. The more you pull it, the faster it spins. A lot of the very cheap ones are not variable speed, and they're very hard to control. You'll also want to get one that has enough power, enough torque to turn the drill bit and drill the things that you need to drill. Those are the two most important things. Most of them are cordless nowadays, so get one that has a battery that'll last a while.
That's been my downfall, I know, yeah.
With my current drill, I got lucky in that there was a free rebate for two free rechargeable batteries when I bought the drill, and I certainly made the best use of that.
Okay, let's get beyond the twist, the most familiar drill bit, to the spade. What is the spade? What do we use it for?
So the spade kind of looks like a spade. They're sometimes called a paddle bit. They are primarily used in construction just for putting holes and stuff basically as quickly as possible. They don't make a very neat hole. They especially tend to rip out the backsides of holes, but they're often used in construction to just rip a hole in like a 2x4 joist or something to run conduit or electrical cables or things like that. Generally, don't use them on anything that you're going to see the hole when you're done.
Okay, and so that's not the one we'd use just on a plaster wall to hang a painting or something?
No, try not to use that one on a plaster wall when you're hanging.
All right.
It'll make a bit of an ugly hole. They also can tend to turn a little bit harder than a twist bit, especially if they like hit a knot or a nail or something. They can really twist the drill right out of your hand. So be a little bit more careful when you use those.
All right, no sprained wrists there. And now from the spade to the auger, what do we do with that?
Now, the auger bits are very similar to twist bits. I mean, they look kind of the same. They're a little bit longer. They're generally for softer materials. Like if you're drilling a hole through inches of wood, the main feature there is that they do come in larger sizes. They come in much longer lengths. You can find them in 18 or 24 inches long. And they have a much deeper flute, which is the curvy thing that runs the length of the bit to remove material. So it's mostly used if you have to drill through a fence post to mount if you're building a fence or doing deck work where you have like 4-inch posts that you really need to put a hole through.
And does that deeper fluting help keep it from jamming as you're going through that longer stretch of wood?
Right, because it's a softer material, the bit tends to feed faster, so you need to remove the material faster. The larger flute makes that easier.
Okay, now we're getting into things that I wouldn't even know how to picture based on their description, the Forstner bit. What is that? Is that the one drill bit that's named after the inventor?
I'm not 100% sure. I believe it probably does relate back to an inventor or a brand name. They are, you look at them, they're sort of like a can from the side that they have these cutting edges around the outside. But at the very bottom of the bit, they also have these scraping edges, sort of like a chisel. So what they really are good at is drilling very precise flat bottom holes. And they also come in much larger sizes, so you can find them in 1, 2, 3-inch sizes. So if you need a very neat hole, if you're building, if you're working on a candlestick holder or some other kind of project, especially where you have visible holes in the finished piece, where you just want to make sure that your hole has very neat fine edges. The Forstner bits are very, very good at this.
Okay, a step drill. Now, that's another one I can't picture just based on the description.
The step drill, it's a kind of a stepped cone is the best way to describe it. Each step, it starts, the pointy end starts out at the narrowest size, maybe an eighth of an inch, and then each step up, maybe a quarter inch of the step is another size up in the bit. And they're made for drilling holes in thin material. They're also very good at being drilling accurate, precise holes without screwing up the material you're drilling into.
So thin material, like a thin layer of plywood? Or?
Well, thin layers of plywood, veneer, thin steel. If you're building, say, you want to build a fancy case for that that radio you've modified or something, linoleum, things of that nature. Sometimes you need to drill a pilot hole to insert them into, but you can't really drill through anything that's bigger than one of the steps. Hmm. And the way you size the hole is you just start drilling the step drill into the hole, and you stop when it reaches the step. That's the diameter you want. And it tends to create really nice, clean holes, especially for metal where if you use a twist bit, it'll tend to pucker the steel around the circumference, and this will eliminate that.
And the last point on our tour, the hole saw.
Now, the hole saw is, I think technically, is probably more of a saw than a drill, but it is something you stick at the end of your drill and make holes. It's a jagged little, it's like a can with a jagged edge around one end. It's not for drilling very deep holes, but it can drill very, very round, very large holes. You can get 4, 5, 6-inch diameter holes through them. They tend to be very, it's another one of those that's largely used in construction. If you want to install a recessed light, for example, you get the hole saw with the right hole, put it right through the drywall.
Steve, before we're done, if we're not a hardcore maker or doing construction just around our household, what's the toolkit? What are the basics we should have in our collection of bits?
Well, I would personally get two sets of twist bits. One is the cheap one, might come with your drill set, might be on the 99-cent aisle at the hardware store, and that's for drilling through drywall, holes that don't need to particularly be pretty, soft woods, things like that. And then get a nice set of preferably titanium-coated bits. It'll be a little bit more expensive, but those are for things where you're drilling through harder materials, maybe some light steel, wood, brass, hardwoods. And those are the ones where you want to keep them sharp, but you don't want to overspin.
Gotcha. Steve, we'll leave it there. That's Steve Hofer. He's an inventor. We've got a link to his piece on drilling on the Central Time Facebook page.